All right. To begin with, for anybody who wasn't in the room 3 minutes ago, to remind people that the draft of their paper is due today. Midnight is fine. Email it to me is what I prefer to get it. I don't know how much I've discussed how we're going to be doing the papers since I've got two different classes I'm doing this in. I can't keep easy track about who I told what to, so if necessary, I'll pay it to you. Again, the basic procedure is that when you're presenting, you have, if you want it, 5 or 10 minutes to talk about the paper, but not to give the paper. That everybody is supposed to have read the paper, and therefore you're not supposed to waste our time by repeating what's in it. But you can see, if you imagine someone has just read your paper, what would you like to tell them about it? What would you like to say, this is what I thought was interesting, or this is the part I don't understand and I would like help with, or anything of that sort. All right. Once you do that, it's open season, and other students are expected to criticize, suggest, you know, ask questions, do whatever seems appropriate when you've read a paper. And in that way, hopefully, all of us can help make each paper better. That's the theory of what we're doing. Also, with regard to the reading for today, I wanted to apologize. After rereading the chapters, I decided I shouldn't have given you Chapter 8. I should have given you either Chapter 4, 5, or 6, or maybe several of them, because Chapter 8 is less interesting and less about the pirates and more about sort of Peter having fun pretending to teach a class than the other ones. But I will be covering some of the stuff that was in the chapters that weren't assigned, and some of you may find it interesting enough so that you want to read those for yourself, because it really is, I think, quite an interesting book. As I was mentioning to somebody earlier, this book actually has connections to this class, because Peter originally published 2 or 3 journal articles, for which I think at least 2 of which I was a referee for them. I then was a referee for this book. And the reason I was competent to comment on the book was that 2 of my students in this class had done papers on 18th century pirates. And therefore, although I didn't know as much as Peter Leeson did about the subject, I knew enough to be able to say useful things about it. So in that sense, although I won't claim that this class is responsible for the book, this class at least had some interaction with the book as it came to be written. Let me start with your comments and questions and then go on to lots of other stuff. Were there things about the book that struck you as worth talking about, raising questions you'd like to discuss or anything of the sort? No. Let me start with what struck me as the most interesting puzzle when I originally read Peter's work, and which I think he partly but not entirely answers. And that is why the way in which pirate ships was as different as it was from the way in which both merchant ships and navy ships were run. That the pirate ships, the captain is elected by majority vote of the crew. It is a not very hierarchical system, that typically the captain gets about twice as much loot as anybody else. The captain could be replaced by vote at any time. And rather than having a single captain who was the officer, you really have 2 roughly equal officers with a division of responsibility between them. All right, the captain commands in battle. The quartermaster, in effect, is in command for most other matters. And they are in some sense in competition, since after all, if they decide they don't like the captain, one thing they can do is to elect the quartermaster captain, or I suppose the other way around. One of the sort of neat little bits that was mentioned as measure of how egalitarian it was that at least in one of the ships, one of the rules was any sailor could come into the captain having dinner and trade dishes with him to make sure the captain was not getting all the good food for himself. So, contrast that. Merchant ship, the captain is appointed by the owners of the ship. The crew has to have no say on him at all. The captain has not unlimited, but very broad authority over the crew while the ship is at sea. The captain's salary is something like 4 or 5 times as large as the crew, so not enormously more, but substantially more. If you look at the British Navy, the difference is even larger, that the British Navy, like the pirates, used the system of sharing the loot. In the Navy, it was called prize money. And so if a naval ship captured an enemy merchantman, the merchantman ends up essentially being auctioned off, and the money is divided among the crew of the ship. They captured him. But the rule, as best I recall, is that of all the money for all the prize money, I think a third of it goes to the captain. A third, if I remember correctly, is divided among the officers, and a third goes to the crew. And depending on the size of the ship, you could easily be talking of a crew of 50 or 100 or 200 people. So the per man share of the crew is much, much, much smaller than that of the captain. From an economist's standpoint, it's puzzling in that, you know, it's all very well to say, well, why would the merchants care about the sailors? But they had to hire the sailors. So you would think if it's really true that the way the pirates ran the ships was the best way of running a ship, that some enterprising merchant would have said, we can get better sailors cheaper if we tell the sailors, unlike all those other people, we're not going to have a captain we've appointed who can do what he likes to you. Take our cargo to where we want to take it, but you get to elect and fire the captain and quartermaster. You can easily enough imagine a firm imitating those pirates. They didn't, as far as I can tell. At least I don't know of any that did. And similarly, the British Navy wasn't sort of in a competitive market, but it was in a competition of a somewhat more lethal sort, since it had to win wars. And therefore, you would think that if it was unambiguously clear that the right way to run a ship was the way the pirates did it, that the Navy would have tended to imitate it. Turning the argument around, you could say if really having an autocratic captain works much better, then why wouldn't pirates say, well, look, it's all very very nice being able to vote for the captain, but the last three pirate ships that did it that way all got sunk, whereas here we've got an autocratic captain who's really competent, and yes, indeed, he takes half the money for himself, but that's all right because he earns more than twice as much as anybody else. So you've got the general puzzle, which I think is an interesting one in these cases, of understanding why the institutions were different. Can anybody describe Gleason's answer to that puzzle? Let me start with the first part. Why did the merchant ships run the way they did? Why weren't the merchant ships essentially run by the crew? Yeah.
It's because they were usually owned by someone who was not the captain of the ship, and so the only way of maintaining their interest when the ship was gone from time was to hire a captain who either had a greater share in the boat or had some sort of a similar tie.
To put the matter more generally, there was a conflict of interest between the owners and the crew. That is, that the crew would like to consume, like to have as much food as possible, to work as little as possible, would prefer not to take a risk of drowning even if it got the cargo there faster and so forth. And not a complete conflict of interest. Obviously, the owners don't want the ship to sink either, but the pattern of behavior that's best for the owners is not the same as the pattern for the crew, yeah?
Well, when they reach their port, the crew receives the price of whatever the cargo is, and they keep half of them saying, the price is seen in China kind of thing.
Yeah. So you need somebody, maybe more than one somebody. Some ships had a supercargo who was essentially the representative of the owners, but not an officer. But you need other people with some power. So that makes some sense. But then the question becomes, why is that not the case for the pirates? Why didn't the pirates have the issue of a conflict of interest between the owners of the ship and the crew of the ship? Who owned the ship? Or the crew, alternatively. That's right. It was stolen property. But I'm not sure that by itself is a sufficient answer. Imagine for a moment that your crew has captured a really nice ship which would do a fine job of piracy. You might say, well, look, being a pirate is an awful lot of work. We've got this very valuable ship. How about we hire a crew, and we go to land and drink lots of grog and, have a good time and live off the profits that the crew will earn for us with our fine ship. All right. Why is that not a working strategy for a pirate crew that's got a good pirate ship? Yep.
Well, as soon as they were outside the land, they go and do whatever they want.
So the first point is that it would be very hard to enforce that contract. And you could imagine maybe we say, well, half of us will go on the ship and we'll have all the guns or something. But it would be a pretty risky arrangement given that everybody's got to be armed in order to function as pirates and so forth. So not that it's impossible to imagine running pirate ships with partly hired crews of some sort, but you can see serious difficulties to it. There's a second reason, I think. And that is that if I correctly interpret the evidence, What do you think the value of a ship was to a pirate? That my initial strategy assumes we've got a good ship and all of those guys on shore don't. And therefore, we can demand good terms for their doing it. And you could imagine, I suppose, if you were in an area there's only one good port, maybe you can enforce the contract on the grounds that when you ever come back to port, if you don't pay us, we'll kill you all or something. But what would you guess from what we know about the behavior of pirates? How large an asset was the pirate ship, yo?
It'll be worth as much as it is to take over the next ship.
That's one way of putting it, but notice that the marginal cost of taking over another ship may well be zero, because after all, in their ordinary business, they're capturing ships in order to loot them. Let me put it differently. If you observe their behavior, and I don't remember anymore how much of this was in the chapters you read, the pirates, when they captured a ship, not uncommonly, they looted the ship and then gave it back to the crew and sent it off. Sometimes they sunk ships. All of that suggests they weren't very valuable to them. And I think that my interpretation, this is something that I don't think Peter goes into, but I think he should, maybe he will if he does another edition, that ships were in effect an excess supply. That is to say, from the standpoint of the pirates, a crew of a given size would only use one ship. In the course of a cruise, they captured two or three. They would presumably keep whatever they thought was the best one, but the rest were really worth nothing to them. So they were perfectly free to simply turn those ships off or to sink them.
You argue that they would return the boats because they wanted them to continue on their...
There's sort of a public good problem there that if there are lots of ships, the odds that you'll get the same one the second time isn't very high. Or putting it differently, that's sort of like fishermen keeping down their catch to keep up the population of fish, which works if you have only one fisherman, but doesn't work very well if you've got 50 or 100. But in fact, there is a different argument, though, which ties into something that could come up later, and that is that there's actually a benefit to returning the ship with its crew, to turning it loose. And that is that since you only do this if the crew doesn't resist you when you attack them, it gives crews an incentive to surrender. That one of the things I'll be coming up with later, it's in one of the chapters I don't think you read, but he discusses at some length, is he's arguing that the pirates were deliberately creating a reputation. And the essence of the reputation is surrender and we won't hurt you. We'll just take your stuff. Don't surrender and we will kill you, torture you, do all sorts of terrible things to you. And it's obvious that one of the points he makes, and it's an important point that people often miss, is that in most contexts, even pretty unequal contexts, a fight to the death is a loss even for the winner. Because unless you've got enormous advantage, even if you think about the pirate case, suppose we're unambiguously going to win. If winning means sinking the merchant ship, we've just destroyed what we're trying to steal. So they have a very strong incentive to try to set up a situation in which ships will surrender to them rather than fighting them. Ideally, even rather than running. Because they can say, if you run and we catch you, we'll treat you badly. And given that, telling the crew, not only will we not slaughter you, we won't even maroon you. We won't even, leave you to try to get home in a longboat or something. Have your ship back. Your employers will be unhappy. Tough luck. It's their loss, not yours. So why should you fight? So that makes some sense. But then, let's think about this for a little bit more. Imagine you're a really enterprising pirate captain. And you say to yourself, look, we only need one ship. We've captured three. Ships are valuable objects. What should we be doing? Should be selling them. Yeah?
The reason I was thinking that you shouldn't do that was because it's readily identifiable.
That's my guess. I'm not sure I'm right, but that's my guess is that what's going on is this is a world before mass production. So each ship is likely to be somewhat different. Consequently, there would be a serious risk if you sell it that someone will identify it as stolen property, trace it back to whoever your middleman is, and arrest him for being a dealer in stolen property and so forth. But there's still another solution, yo?
Could you sell to other pirates?
Well, if all the pirates have lots of ships, that's not going to work very well. If the market price of ships to pirates is zero because they always capture them. No, who's the person you ought to be selling it to? That's right. So that's an interesting puzzle, and I'm actually I emailed Peter yesterday with some comments, because what is the very 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 familiar form of criminal activity which consists in effect of stealing something and then selling it back to its owner?
Extortion.
Well, not quite. Extortion is close. Kidnapping.
Oh, dang.
Right?
Oh, I was
going to yes?
tell you. The Romans had something similar to that with burning houses down.
Yes.
And what they would do, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah.
They would light someone's house on fire and then charge them to put it out.
Yeah. I have certainly seen that assertion, and it may even be true. I don't know enough about the, but yeah, but yeah.
The richest Roman of all time, Crassus, he did something similar where he would, I don't know if he set fire, there were certain rumors, but he ran a firefighter brigade, and they would go and burn down houses. I mean, they would go to burning houses, and they would, and before they put out the fire, they would buy them for like a really low price.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That's what it was.
Yeah.
That's
and
exactly
then
what it was.
And I guess the real estate was, you know, you like, you know, turn the, you know, shack or whatever into like a condo, you know, in the modern
right.
province.
Because the value would be so drastically reduced.
Yeah. Yeah. But the real estate itself, because it's in the middle of the Rome is still valuable.
Yeah. Let me, however, warn you of my standard rule, which is that one should view with distrust any historical anecdote that makes a good enough story to have survived on its literary merit. So all you say may, for all I know, be entirely true, but I would want to know how good the evidence is, because given that it makes a good story, it's going to propagate whether it's true or not. Anyway, I could talk about that. Another context with it, yeah.
I don't know how you're going to do this, but it seems like if, when you have a huge ship, it'd be kind of easy to set the authority, you know, to say, well, I'll meet you here or transact with you here, and then by the time they come about, they set them up so that
you trap them.
You know,
but that means you need a trusted middleman of some sort. But you could have a middleman, let us say, from some country other than the owner of the ship's country, where he didn't have much influence, where you could... It's not that hard to imagine. The U.S., for example, the United States, one of the U.S. colonies, could have said, look, we're not in the business of enforcing English naval law. So, if you can arrange to meet with the owners of the ship that you stole... in Baltimore Harbor with a suitable amount of money from them. That is, I'm not saying it's necessarily easy, but it's an interesting puzzle. Because if you look at 18th century English crime of a less extreme form, it's pretty clear that there were well-established institutions for buying your property back. Anybody here know who Jonathan Wild was? Are any of you familiar with the Dreigroschenoper, with the three-penny opera? Yes? No? You know the German version of it, which is the original. Three-penny opera is a fairly famous musical, and one of the major characters is a fellow called Mr. Peachum. I don't remember what he is in the German, in the Dreigroschen version. And Mr. Peachum pretty clearly is modeled on Jonathan Wild, who was an 18th century Englishman who combined three different professions. He was a thief catcher, a recoverer of stolen property, and a wholesale employer of thieves. And he did it for 10 years until they hanged him. And my understanding of that system was that if what you had lost was something that was much more valuable to you than anybody else, let us say a document which showed your ownership of property or something like that, or a treasured memento, you went to the right contacts and you said, you know, if you can find this for me, I will pay the following amount. And they, in effect, went to the thieves or to somebody connected with the thieves and bought it back from them. So I am a little bit curious, and maybe there is a good answer, as to why that kind of institution didn't exist, that why they either turned the ships loose or sank them. Yeah?
Maybe those middlemen, they were offered by...
Maybe. I at least don't know what the answer is, and I think it's an.
Yeah, about the whole, the transaction in Baltimore Harbor. You know, you could do that, but I don't know if it would help you that much because the whole impressment scandal that led up to the World War XII showed, you know, the British and the Royal Navy didn't care about any law of their own, and, you know, they had enough guns to enforce it on them.
But they didn't. They did not, after all, win the War of 1812.
Yeah, it's true they didn't, but...
But anyway, it doesn't have to be, why didn't the Spanish make arrangements for British ships and the British for Spanish ships? It's not as if you had a world government. So it is in fact an interesting puzzle. And part of what intrigues me about it is that we have another set of pirates who did do these things. All right? The other set of pirates are the Barbary pirates, which Peter refers to as corsairs. The Barbary pirates had absentee owners, employed crews, and ransom. I don't know if they ransomed ships, but they certainly ransomed captives. And what was the difference? The Barbary pirates were state-sponsored. There were three major ports in North Africa. Each ship was associated with one of those ports. The ports were effectively independent governments under suzerainty of the Ottoman Empire. So they were sort of semi-independent. And the Barbary pirates, in fact, had Ottoman troops as part of their forces. So that's sort of an interesting contrast between two institutions very similar in what they were doing, but one of them with and one of them without state sponsorship, which meant since your ship had to always go back to the same port, the people who owned the ship could then insist on collecting their cut of the loot, unlike the other cities. So all of that struck me as quite an interesting kind of contrast. One other question, which is sort of related to some of this, is why the division of loot was as even as it was. If you think about most forms of employment, I am reasonably certain that my wage from the law school is not identical to that of each other professor. And if you become lawyers, you probably will not find, I don't know, there may be partnerships where there's a fixed rule that each partner gets 10% of the profits or something, but I think it's much more common that there are various ways in which some members, some employees, or even some joint owners get more than others based more or less on productivity or contribution or something of that sort. So why do they have an even distribution? Yeah?
Prevent mutiny?
I'm not sure. Why would you have?
Because that way, the people, if everyone's making an equal amount of money, there's less bitterness amongst lower members.
More bitterness among higher members. What's to prevent my saying, well, look, I'm the guy who really, you know, the last three times I was the first one aboard and I was brave and you guys are all right, but you're sort of wimps. I should have gotten twice as much money and I didn't.
But from a majority perspective, you're not going to have a small class of people that are going to be mutiny again.
But you can see it either way. You could imagine a situation where there is a minority who the others think are doing somewhat less. And I'm not saying your explanation is impossible, but I don't think it's obviously right. The other possibility I was thinking of has to do with basically bargaining problems, with the fact that getting agreement on a division is maybe hard. The story I like to tell when explaining some related ideas is to imagine that you've got a couple of bank robbers and they've gotten away with the loot, but they expect the police to show up in half an hour or so, so they've got to divide the loot up fast and go. And each of them really believes he's done more than half the work. People usually, as you may have noticed, are always, in my experience at least, it always seems to me like I've done more than half the work in anything. But oddly enough, it seems that way to my wife or daughter or whoever the other person is I'm working with as well. So neither of them thinks that it's fair for him to get half. And yet it's very likely they'll agree on a 50-50 division. And the reason is that 50-50 looks like a unique solution in the sense in which nothing else does. And the technical term for this is what's sometimes called a Schelling point, because Thomas Schelling wrote it. Article about it, there's another term I forget, which is used for it. So I think one of the patterns you will sometimes observe in bargaining of various sorts is that people look for what seem like unique or special kinds of divisions and follow those. So that's a possible explanation. And of course, it wasn't entirely even. That is, not only did the captain get more, some lower officers who got an extra half share, and there were some rules, the first person to spot a ship gets the best pistols on the ship. That was one of the rule that one of the ships had. And so there are various other ways in which they're rewarding it. In any case, it seemed to me that all of that is sort of an interesting set of considerations raised by this. Yeah.
We were talking about why you would have an executive return, let those ships return to the crew.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when, I would assume that they are trying to go on vacation, and so maybe they'll have to see what say, well, this is a flag, you know, that the pirates that let you go. So spread the word, and then next time
time will come. But what happens when that flag, that trademark, is pirated by another flag?
Yes, yes. That's a general issue in a sense. The sort of the next thing that I wanted to get into is the chapter that you can read, but it wasn't one of the assigned ones, has to do with the skull and crossbones. So the question is, why did the pirates? I should say the pirates did not all have the same flags. There were a number of variants, but there were some common themes, and some of them really did fly the skull and crossbones and other things vaguely similar. Why? What was the function of the skull and crossbones? What was it? Signaling. That's right. This is a way of saying we're the guys who will treat you really badly if you fight us. But now, why wasn't it so? Why did they need a skull and crossbones? Why couldn't they just say, well, look, at the point when we're trying to seize the ship, it's going to be pretty obvious, like, you know, we're shooting at them or something, therefore they surrender. Is there any particular reason? And the answer, no reason why you should know the answer, but the answer is, in fact, in the book. And that is they had competitors. Their competitors were the Coast Guard. That what you had at the time in a variety of states, especially Spain, was even though they were at peace with the rest of the world, they had what they considered their territorial waters, which in the case of Spain, I think, basically included most of the West Indies. So their view was that they were entitled to seize merchant ships that weren't Spanish merchant ships that were in what they thought of as their territorial waters. And at least Peter's argument is that the Coast Guard were more constrained than the pirates were. That the Coast Guard might cheat. They might seize a valuable ship that was actually not in their water. But it would be a lot harder from their standpoint to slaughter the crew or torture them to death or whatever, given that they were legal official people working for the Spanish government, than it was for the pirates, who had no constraints of that sort. I mean, they were outlaws already. They get hanged whether they slaughtered the crew or not if they were caught. So the argument is that the Coast Guard could not act in the way in which the pirates could act. That acting in that way gave the pirates an advantage. It made ships willing to surrender to them. Hence, that it would be in the interest of the Coast Guard for merchant ships to think they were pirates. So then the argument is that you have a symbol defining you as a pirate, which is clear enough so that a Coast Guard captain who flies the Jolly Roger is going to get in trouble. He will be seen as abandoning his legal status. On the other hand, a pirate ship that flies the Jolly Rogers is already in trouble. It isn't any worse trouble. So therefore, you have what Peter refers to, the usual technical term, a separating equilibrium. Think about signaling in general, because he has a... One of the reasons that chapter is probably worth reading is he has at least a brief discussion of the general theory of signaling, that people do things designed to make other people believe certain things about them. You take a girl out on a date and you take her to a good restaurant. And why are you doing that? Aside from the fact that you like the restaurant, one of the things you want to signal is that you're pretty well off, which makes you a good catch. One of them is you're generous. One of them maybe is you've got good taste. All of those are features that make you a more attractive boyfriend, husband, whatever, for her. But now the question is, how about if those things aren't true? Well, if you're poor, you might take her to an expensive restaurant. It's a lot harder for you. If you don't have good taste, then you have to find out what a good restaurant is and so forth. So the basic argument is that signaling works when sending a signal is less expensive for people whom it's true than for whom it's false. Doesn't work perfectly. But you then, a pooling equilibrium is one where either everybody sends a signal or nobody does, and then it's of no use. And what you want is a situation where you have a signal such that there's some advantage to sending the signal. The advantage is greater than the cost for people for whom the signal is true, less than the cost for whom it's false. And quite a lot of human behavior can be seen in that way. That if you think about gift giving, for example, which is really quite puzzling, if you start thinking about for a while the pattern of giving presents, and the first question that would naturally occur to an economist is, why aren't presents always cash? That after all, the recipient probably knows what he needs better than you do. Once in a while, you might have a case where, I saw that and it was just the thing for you and you didn't know about it. But most of the time, you are spending $20 to buy something that's worth $10 for the recipient. If it was worth $20, he would have bought it already. And so that's a bit of a puzzle. And one possible answer is that what you want to signal is, I know you and pay attention enough to you so that I can tell what you're like. Hence, I'm the sort of person you should value, you should want to maintain a friendship with, treat well, and so forth. I sometimes think of it in terms of the economic analysis of altruism, of the pattern of people valuing other people. And the argument is that if I'm an altruist, giving a present at all is a signal that I'm an altruist, because after all, if I don't care about you, giving you a $20 present costs me $20. If your happiness is in my utility function's value to me, giving you a $20 present only costs me $5, because I'm getting a $15 benefit in your happiness for my $20 cost. So in that sense, giving presents itself can be seen as signaling. But giving presents instead of cash is something which you can do a better job of if you're paying attention to somebody. If you care about someone, you're probably paying attention to them, and therefore the argument is that's a signal again. So I'm not sure all that's right. I should say I do, in general, present giving is puzzling for a bunch of reasons, but that could be another discussion. Puzzling to economists, not to anybody else, but yeah.
Yeah.
See, part of the fun of being an economist, you've got all these puzzles that other people don't have. Yes.
The person that gives to kind of gives him.
Yes.
So there's one, I know people who are, the girlfriend gives him, look at Xbox.
Yeah.
You know, onwards, but then there are gifts that are kind of more, they have no utility outside of being a symbolic gift.
That's right.
And so that's kind of, I don't know, I never noticed that there's a difference like that.
Some of us have in the top shelves of our kitchens, nice pieces of china we have never used and are never going to use that were given as wedding presents. Tolkien mentions what he calls mathems, and a mathem is a gift whose only purpose is to be a gift. So after somebody gives it to you, you eventually give it to somebody else who eventually gives it to somebody else and so forth. But the general point really is that signaling is an interesting phenomenon, is one way of making sense of part of the world. It's one way of making sense of the puzzle of why going to college gives you a higher income. That this may not seem like a puzzle to you, but people who think about it, it's not at all clear that most college students have actually earned anything useful in college. Certainly some of them have. But I think there's a good deal of evidence that quite a sizable fraction of college students end up knowing no more when they leave than when they come. But there's also good evidence that most people get a higher income as a result of going to college. And so one possible explanation is that going to college signals that you're the kind of person who can hand in his homework on time, you know, have a bunch of characteristics which are valuable to employers, and that therefore the employers say, you know, if you couldn't even make it through college, you surely aren't going to be of any use to me. And that would be a signaling case. And it might pay for you to go to college even though you knew you weren't going to learn anything, on the grounds that it's a way of sending a signal, and it's a signal which is easier to send if you're an organized, hardworking sort of person for whom it's not a serious problem going to college than if you're the kind of person that the company, that the employer doesn't want to hire, for whom it is hard. So all of that, I think, makes a good deal of sense. But in any case, what I've said gives a reasonable explanation of why they had the Jolly Roger. Yeah.
But what about the situation where Pirate Group A is trying to get rid of the vision that...
And Pirate B Group B free rides on it.
Right, and so what they do is they do sink the ship, take the money, kill them, or whatever, you know.
Well, one pirate ship has no incentive to sabotage the others. It's just they have an inadequate incentive to develop the reputation. That is, if you imagine there are three pirate ships at the time that cruised out those particular waters. Each of them bears all, insofar as there's a cost to developing the reputation, each of them bears all the cost and gets only a third of the benefit. Right, so it's a public good problem. But if the public isn't too big and the ratio of benefit to cost is high, it still pays you to do it. Right? You know, when assuming that any of you go to any trouble to look nice, I like to comment that my wife has this bizarre idea that some colors of shirts don't go with some colors of pants, and I've never really understood this idea. But people do seem to believe this, and insofar as you try to conform to those rules, you are to some extent producing a benefit for all the people around you whose visual field looks prettier. But when you do that, you get enough of the benefit yourself so that it pays you to do it. So that sometimes public goods are produced privately through the technical term in the economics literature, the privileged minority, meaning that they've got the privilege of paying for what everybody else gets because the value to them alone is enough. Or to take maybe a clearer case, repainting your house. All right, repainting your house makes the neighborhood look better. But in particular, you see more of your house than anybody else. Therefore, you get enough of the benefits that you're willing to do it. So I think that makes a certain amount of sense. So in this case, it seems that you're pointing out a real problem, but it's not clear that developing that reputation is all that costly, that there's no particular reason why they should want to torture people to death, and therefore it's not a big cost to them when the ship they go after surrenders to them to be willing to be nice to the crew once they've looted all the stuff. They presumably don't greatly want not to torture the people, and therefore it's not a big cost to them if when the ship resists them, they slaughter the crew. So it looks as though it may be a case where maintaining the reputation isn't very costly and it's worth something. And in addition to that, presumably the reputation isn't entirely shared, because to some extent the merchants may well have heard, you know, it's Dread Pirate Roberts who's cruising these waters, or it's Blackbeard who's cruising these waters. The individual captains did have individual reputations. And I don't think it was that sharp, but I think it was more a matter of there are a limited number of pirates, there are different places they can go. Pirate is successful for a while, and then he retires or gets killed or something. Now another. So I don't think it's the case that in a given area, there would have been 50 pirate ships at one time that might go after you. How large the numbers are, I don't know. But I think Peter has an estimate of a couple of thousand pirates total. And some of the ships had big crews. Like if the ship had a crew of 100, that would be only 20 ships. They aren't all at sea at the same time. If 10 ships are at sea at the same time, and some of them go this direction, some of them go this direction, you might have at least a very rough idea of who it was. Another chapter, and one which is really related to this, as I've referred to already implicitly, is the question of torture by pirates. According to Peter, there is no evidence that any pirate ever made anybody walk the plank. That seems to be a fictional invention. However, there's quite a lot of evidence that pirates sometimes tortured their captors pretty brutally. And there are a couple of fairly obvious reasons to do so. You're a pirate. Why, other than that you might be a sadist, why else might you want to torture under some circumstances people who you've captured? What are you going to get out of them? Reputation. One of them is a reputation. One of them is to punish them for fighting you. What else?
Didn't they want, like, location of
loot? They'd like to. After all, the crew might have, especially if you're going to send the crew off with their ship, they may have hidden the money somewhere in the ship. So one reason is to force them to tell you where the loot is. Suppose you're the captain of a merchant ship, and you've got quite a lot of gold money in your cabin, and you can see that the pirate's going to capture you, and you don't like pirates. What might you be tempted to do?
Throw
it into the ocean. How will the pirates feel about this behavior? So one thing the pirates might do is to make it pretty clear that if we suspect, and after all, they can interrogate all of the crew separately, it may not all be loyal. If we find out that you threw the money into the ocean, you're going to have a very unpleasant death. Okay. So all of that makes some sense. Now, Peter suggests two other motives, which may be correct, I don't know. One of them is retaliating against attempts to stop piracy. So if you imagine that the people you've captured are merchants from a Caribbean port where the governor has been making a point of trying to send out warships to capture you, you might say, we don't like people from that port, so we're normally merciful, but we're not merciful to them, and maybe the governor will get the message and stop going after us. And the other reason, which sounds a little bit romantic but may be right, is to punish bad captains. So imagine that there is a captain who has the reputation that he beats his crew, sodomizes the cabin boys, starves the crew in order not to have to spend money on their food, confiscates their wages on various bad excuses and so forth. You could certainly imagine that if the pirates know this, and they might, I don't know how good the reputations are, that they will say, we would like, he's been hurting people like us, we're going to punish him. And you can even say that they might say, and furthermore, we are going to do better if sailors like us. If sailors like us, some of them may tell us when ships are sailing. Some of them, if their captain tries to run away, may mutiny or may deliberately do a bad job or something. So if we have the reputation that we're on their side, that we punish captains who mistreat their crews, maybe that will help us. I don't know if any of that is right, but at least Peter's view was that one incentive, the one motive was to get loot either by revealing hidden loot or by punishing people who threw loot overboard, that one motive was to discourage local governments from trying to hunt down the pirates, but that one motive also was to punish captains who were believed to behave badly. But he's got a good quote in there, which I sort of liked at least, from one of the pirates. "I scorn to do anyone a mischief when it is not for my advantage." And that's the sort of non-sadist, not non-virtuous. That's the person who's neutral on the question of hurting other people. He'll only do it if he gets something out of it, which I suspect describes at least a good deal of human behavior. All right, there's another chapter, which is also, I thought, quite interesting, and that's on the question of whether or not the pirate draft, probably the pirates drafted crews. So imagine we've got a ship with room for 100 people, we've only got 80 people on it because there weren't enough in the port to recruit, or some people got killed or something. We've just captured a vessel with some sailors on it. Those sailors can't walk on water. Why don't we say to those sailors, all right, you're now pirates. And after all, once you've been pirates for a while, you can't stop being a pirate very easily because they'll hang you if they catch you. And the question is, did they do that? And Peter's answer is they mostly didn't. That they occasionally did if they had specialized needs. If they needed a carpenter, say. Their carpenter had died, carpenter on the captured ship, you're now a pirate. But he thinks that what typically happened was that the pirates first found out which members of the crew wanted to join them, then made a big show of forcing those people to join them, sent the rest of the crew home, and the pirates who had joined the ship gave their friends who hadn't, sorry, the crew members who had joined the pirates, gave their friends who hadn't joined the pirates advertisements to put in the local newspaper saying, poor so-and-so was compelled to join pirate ship such and such. Why do you think they did this? Because if they get caught, they at least have a chance of persuading the court that they were not willingly pirates, so they were forced to do it, and therefore shouldn't be hanged. Right? And he's got the advertisements. That is, that's sort of part of the neat thing about that particular discussion. It's not just speculation. We know that such ads were being put up, and that seems the obvious reason why he would have put them up. The rest of his evidence, I don't remember, because I haven't reread that chapter recently. But I thought that was sort of a neat bit of what they were doing. All right, let me go on to a number of other points that he's making, one of which has his attempt to distinguish government from governance, which I think was one of the parts where I felt as though he was making too much of an effort to argue for his and my political views as opposed to understanding pirates. And, you know, I have no objection to arguing for those views, but it seems to me that the book is more interesting with focusing on the pirates. And how convincing did people find his explanation of why a homeowners association and a government were different? All right, what does he say? He says the government uses force to make you meet its terms and the homeowners association doesn't. In what sense is that true or false? Yeah?
It's true to an extent where moving out is fairly easy, but it's false to an extent where it's still coercing you in a certain way. It's just that penalties are less than what a government might have.
That is, for a moment, most, though not all, governments permit you to leave. So in that sense, you could say you can move out in either case. Homeowners association, it is true you have the option of leaving, but you don't have the option of remaining and violating their rules. They will use force to stop that. So in that sense, it seems to me that he's making the difference look larger than it is, and that the critical difference, which he certainly is coming up, but which he doesn't really discuss very much, is the question of property rights. That is to say that if you believe that the U.S. government owns the territory of the U.S., then it's legitimate to say we aren't really coercing you. These are the terms on which we'll let you stay. And the response to that is, but how did they get ownership of the territory of the U.S.? What's their legitimate grounds for that? If you believe that the Homeowners Association legitimately owns its condo, after all, the developers paid to have that condo built, then it makes sense to say they're not coercing you when they say these are the terms on which you can come. But it really does hinge, it seems to me, on the intuition which I share with Peter, but which is not obviously true, that the condo association has a better claim to be the owner of the condo than the U.S. government does to be the owner of the U.S. And I think that's a point which he doesn't really make or explore adequately. Now, a different question would be, does it matter in terms of how well it works? And I would argue that we have more reason to expect the condo to have good rules than to expect the U.S. to have good rules, because the condo association comes into existence when somebody builds the condo, sets up the rules, and then sells bits of the condo to people. It, in doing so, has an incentive to try to design a set of rules that people will want to be under, because that way it can do a better job of selling. The U.S. government does not have to recruit citizens. In fact, it turns quite a lot of them away at the door, unfortunately. And therefore, it's not under that constraint. So the mechanisms to get good rules from the U.S. government depends on political mechanisms, on, you know, democracy and such, and we could discuss my reasons for thinking that it's not a very effective system, although it's not completely worthless, obviously. But I think on the whole, I am more, as I may have said before, my view is that the ideal form of government is competitive dictatorship, because that's how restaurants and hotels are run, that I have no vote in what the restaurant serves, an absolute vote in whether I'm their customer, and it's then in their incentive, as long as there are other restaurants I can readily go to do a good job. But so that would be a practical argument. But in terms of his basic argument, it seems to me that he would have made a much better argument if his example had not been the condo association, but something like a feud legal system. That is to say that there are mechanisms for enforcing rules which don't depend on anything we would call a government. If you think of the government as a single organization which has a monopoly on the use of force, or at least on authorizing the use of force, which in some sense is a little complicated, because you can always say, well, authorizing just means they said you can do it, and after all, mothers didn't use force too, and why is that different? But for a moment, we at least have some conceptual difference between what a government is and what other people are. And if you think about the Roman child gypsies, who are my favorite example for this purpose because they're the least structured feud society I know of, they have a mechanism which in fact results in people usually not cheating each other and usually having to bear costs if they do cheat each other, but which doesn't depend on any centralized authority. And it seems to me that's a better example for the governance versus government distinction he's making, although a more exotic one from the standpoint of his readers. And you can then look at the other feud societies we looked at Iceland and at Somalia, and those are all systems where you don't have any centralized enforcer of rights, and yet rights do get, not perfectly enforced, in any system they do get enforced by some kind of a decentralized mechanism. So that, it seems to me, would be a better argument for what he's saying than the argument he offers. The comments, people agree, disagree, follow, don't follow, anything. You're all being too quiet today. I'm going to just do too much of the talking. That's no good. So, different point. And this is one where he's citing Buchanan and Tulloch. And unfortunately, Buchanan is no longer around to ask. I'm not sure if Tulloch's still alive or not. And I haven't read the particular thing he's citing, but I think there are some problems with the argument. And he's looking at the question of the range of decision-making mechanisms between dictatorship and unanimity. All right, if you say we've got a group of people, we're making a decision for them, one decision-making mechanism is I'm the dictator and I decide. Another at the opposite extreme is nothing happens unless everybody agrees to it. And then there are lots of things in between. A simple majority vote, supermajority takes two-thirds, so forth. And could somebody describe what, by Peter's account, is the trade-off between as you move along that range? What is the reason, what is the advantage and disadvantage of dictatorship? What's the advantage and disadvantage of unanimity? And he's at least implying that as you get closer to unanimity, you get more of one and less of the other. Could any of you think you could put it in your own words? All right. The way he puts it is that dictatorship minimizes decision-making costs because you don't have to get people to agree, but that unanimity minimizes, remember the term he uses, but basically bad outcome costs, because if anybody is made worse off, you don't get unanimous decision. And I don't think that's quite right. He may be right about decision-making costs, but what is the bad outcome that you might get under a unanimity rule that would make you worry about it? Our rule, yeah?
No decision at all?
Yeah, nothing happens. Bargaining breakdown. Imagine that we say, let me take a real example from my other class a couple of hours ago. And this is, there are computer games, which I had not realized, which are sports-based computer games in which the people, these are things for things like basketball and football, in which you have real players in them. That is to say, the characters in the game, in fact, represent the real players on a real team for each team. And from his description, what?
Oh, is it like fantasy football?
That would be, well, yeah, FFB, I guess, is one of the terms that. FFB was one of the referred to when I assumed that was the fantasy football. He mentioned three different games. And they don't actually give them the names, but they give them the numbers on the jerseys, the physical appearance, sort of all the characteristics as far as they can. And that's part of the fun of the game, presumably, that you're having the real team, as it were, only it's on your computer and you're making its decisions. Suppose, and this is my intellectual property theory class, suppose we take the position that in order to do that, you must have the permission of the player. Suppose, furthermore, that the game is a whole lot better if you completely match the team. Do you see the problem that raises? All right, if we can get permission from all 400 players, I'm imagining 20 teams with 20 players each, I don't know what the real numbers are. So if I can get permission from all 400 players, we can really do a good game and make lots of money. 399 players, nah, we can do a game, but it won't be nearly as good because somebody will be unhappy at the fact that there's one bogus player in there. 390, nah, much worse. What's the problem? You are a player. And you say, well, you know, this game, they got a total of $50 million that they can pay in licensing fees for permission to do this game. How much of it do I want? I'd like to have all of it. I'm not going to get all of it. But I might very well like more than 1/400th of it. And there's going to be a very strong temptation to try to be a holdout, to try to say, look, all those other guys, yeah, they were willing to do it for $100,000 each. They quite a lot of money, but I really think I ought to serve $200,000. So that's a problem with the unanimous decision rule. And I think one of the reasons why organizations rarely use unanimous decision rules, I'm going to qualify this in a minute, but let me first say the only organization we've looked at that used a real unanimous decision rule, and I'm going to argue that Peter is wrong about his, is the Amish. That the Amish, apparently, as far as I could tell, if the clergy proposed that we should change the Maidung in such and such a way, we should change the rules to permit telephones as long as they're not inside your house, which is one of the real issues. Can we have a phone in an outbuilding that we and two of our neighbors use so we can make outgoing calls if we need to? And that proposal is made. And it sounds as though at the point when it's made, it can't be implemented until there are no objections. All right? And it might be hard, maybe not. Maybe there's enough social pressure that they get it. But that's the only one I can think of. What's the reason that I think Peter is wrong in describing the constitutional process for his ships as unanimity? There's a sense in which it's unanimity, a sense in which it isn't. What happens? Let's suppose that we've got a bunch of pirates. We've got 100 pirates on shore, and they're saying there's this nice ship here. We're planning to go off. We've got a draft of our constitution. These are the rules we want to sail under. And 90 of them say, great, we like those rules, and 10 of them say we don't. What's going to happen?
90 of them go.
That's right, precisely. So that it's unanimous in the same sense in which my restaurant is unanimous, right? But it's not unanimous in the sense of we've got a fixed set of people who are, as it were, locked in, And until they get unanimous agreement, nothing happens. What's the one context in our legal system where unanimity is required? Juries, of course. For most, though not all, there are some exceptions, but the basic rule in our legal system is that you need a unanimous vote in order to convict somebody of a crime. And now a jury is not a very large group. It's not nearly as big as the crew of a ship, say, so it's not as hard a problem. And presumably, part of the theory of that, at least one would hope part of the theory of that, is if there's any doubt, we want to acquit people. I'm not sure it really works that way, but that is a case, that's the only case that occurs to me where we actually are using a unanimity rule. Other things worth talking about. So anyway, all I'm saying is that I think he makes it too simple in trying to see this sort of continuous change from dictatorship to unanimity as all one thing going up and one thing going down. I would think that it's true that bargaining costs usually go up as you move to higher and higher percentages required to agree, but outcome costs change in both directions. And in particular, one of the interesting cases, though not one he discusses, is suppose that you don't have a way of making side payments. What I mean by a side payment is you don't have some option in which if you don't like the rule everybody else likes, we can compensate you in order to get you to agree to it. If we have no such mechanism, then unanimity only happens when nobody is worse off under whatever is being proposed. But that's a fairly unlikely situation, and then you're going to not only block some undesirable, but lots of changes that are desirable in the sense that they help lots of people and hurt a few people. Right? And side payments are to some extent a solution to that. On the other hand, once you introduce side payments, you now have the opposite problem, which is the person who pretends to be opposed to it in order to get paid off not to be, even though he actually benefits by it, just like everybody else. All of this, in a way, is connected with what I think of as, that we were discussing a minute ago in the pirate case, the problem of private production of public goods. That with unanimity, we can all chip in to get something we all are benefited by, but it's hard to get that unanimity, and short of unanimity, each person wants to be a free rider and let the other people pay for whatever he's getting, which is a problem. Something else that I would, a couple of other things, one sort of minor thing, just in terms of tying it in with other things we've looked at, is you will notice that the pirates, like the Athenians and the Irish and us, use oaths to try to get truth, as it were. So that there are various stages, steps, in which, as Peter describes it, a pirate is expected to promise something, to swear to something, and one doesn't know whether or not it, how binding it was, but presumably binding enough so they bothered to do it.
I
want to be interrupted. I don't have another 15 minutes to say.
So one of them is, the author talks about how if somebody, loses their right arm, they get paid $500 and left arm $400.
Right.
How does that fit into the whole, theory that these are all hardened criminals and they're only doing what's best for them and it's all self-interest?
But the argument is first agreeing to that is in my interest insofar as I might be the guy who loses my right arm. In addition to that, agreeing to that makes you less likely to hang back when we're attacking. Because if you say, if I'm in the front and one of them gets a sword blow at my right arm, I'm going to starve to death, you're going to be less willing to take that risk than if you say, well, of course, I don't want to lose my right arm, but, if I do lose my right arm, assuming I don't die, at least I'll get lots of money and I'll be able to, drink myself to a slow death on shore, or maybe not even drink myself, maybe become an innkeeper or do something that doesn't require two arms. So I think the argument is that by insuring them, that in a sense, it's interesting because in a way it's a more direct argument than our workers' comp kind of system is. Because mostly employers don't particularly want their employees to do things that might get them hurt. So therefore, we don't have to tell the employee, it's all right, you can take the risks and we'll compensate you if you lose it. But the pirates are engaged in a very hazardous profession. And it's a hazardous profession where you can control the hazard to some extent by what you do, and we don't want you to. We want you to be willing to be in the front line, as it were, when we're boarding a ship. Consequently, we're going to compensate in this fashion. So I think that part makes a good deal of sense, doesn't it? You had a second question.
Yeah, I might have read this wrong, but it sounded like when you were describing merchant vessels, they were smaller than pirate vessels?
Smaller crew. I'm not sure they're smaller vessels. I think part of what's going on, you have to remember that in the technology of this time, a ship could be at sea for a very long time. Have any of you read the Aubrey Matcherman novels? One of them, I think, was made into Captain Commander, I think, was made into a movie. If you want good historical novels, they're very good. They're set in the British Navy during the Napoleonic War. And I think the author knows his stuff. That is, it feels very much as though he's looked at the primary sources and figured out what that world was like. And one of the things that's impressive, in a sense, is just how independent ships were. That you had a crew of fairly skilled, some of whom were fairly skilled people. They might be away from shore for several months. They might be away from home for a year or longer than a year. They might have their ship very badly damaged and have to rebuild the thing. And they could, to a considerable extent. One of the things you don't want to do is to have more sailors than you need. Because more sailors than you need both raises your costs, and it also means that your water isn't going to last as long and your food isn't going to last as long. So I think what's going on is that merchant ships have the minimum crew. Merchant ships have whatever is the number in which they can do it. In addition to which, a merchant ship has less need than a warship for a crew, because they're not planning to fight hand-to-hand if they can help it. They more nearly have the option, if the weather is bad, of staying in port. And so forth. So I think you're getting pirate ships which have a much higher number of people for the size of the ship, and that's the big difference. But I don't think the pirate ships are consistently larger, although that would depend on the case.
Well, it didn't make sense if they steal their vessels from merchants.
Yes, that's where they're going to be coming from, that's right. Yeah. No, the extreme case, actually, which we haven't covered, is if you look at naval matters in antiquity, at Greek triremes and the like. They were basically, the warships were sufficiently packed with people that they had to ground them at that night. So the normal pattern is the ship is at sea during the day, and usually it doesn't stay afloat at night. You usually beach it at night. There is, I think, one real naval catastrophe that the Athenians suffer when the enemies catch their ship, their fleet on the beach and burn it. But more generally, there's part of the reason I know about this is that in the course of reading up on the stuff from my 18th century English article, one of the things that comes up there is galley slavery. And as you may remember from my article, the popular view of galley slavery is historical nonsense. That the popular view is that the Romans sentenced people to the galleys. They didn't. The Romans might have slaves, the whole crew might be slaves, the Romans had slavery, but galley slavery as a punishment is a Renaissance invention. And reading up on naval stuff in classical antiquity, one of the really fun things I came across is this whole puzzle about classical warships, because we know that the warships in classical antiquity had numbers associated with them. So you would have a 2, a 3, a 5. We have no explanation in writing of what those numbers meant. And the conjecture, at least of the book that I read on it, is that the number was the number of men at an oar position. So if you imagine something like a Renaissance galley where you've got an oar with 3 men on it, that's a 3. If you imagine a Greek trireme where you have 3 banks of oars, one above the other, and 1 man at each oar, that's also a 3. So how do you get a 4? You have something like a Greek trireme big enough so you can get 2 men on the lowest oar. A 5, 2, 2, and 1. So, and that at least seems consistent with the data. And generally, there's almost nothing bigger than a 5, except for the Ptolemaic 40. The Ptolemaic Egypt, which was a very wealthy society, had launched one ship, which is described as a 40. And if you think of 40 or 20? I think it's a 40. Is that right? No, I'm wrong. It's a 20. It's to 20. And that's impossible. And the reason... Let me take a pass on that, because I'm not sure if I'm remembering right, it's a 20 or 40. But the point is that if you figure out how... There's a limit to how many men you can get on an oar. If you think about how an oar works, the far end can't go further than a man's forward and back. That means that if you have... If it's too long, the near end isn't doing anything. It's hardly moving. And it works out, I think that's 40, because it works out that the largest number of people you would get on an oar was about 7, 6 or 7. That means that you have a trireme, you can have 7, 7, and 6, which gives you a 20. A very big trireme, a huge trireme. Nobody got more than 3 decks. That apparently was not technologically practical. And so how could they have possibly gotten to 40? And the explanation is that it was a double-hulled ship. It was, what's the modern term for a ship with 2 hulls? Catamaran. It was a giant rowed catamaran. And the result was that there are 20 men on this oar position and 20 men on this oar, and that's 40. And the basis for that is that we have a fairly detailed description of some of the numbers associated with it. And it had twice as many steering oars as a regular ship had. It had a crew of 4,000 sailors and 1,000 soldiers. It was roughly the displacement of a World War II cruiser. This is a very big thing. There was only one of them ever built, so it must not have been a success. But it was quite interesting. But part of that is if you think about how you've got people packed into that ship, you aren't going to live there. All right, you pack them in, you go out to sea, you fight a battle, you go back to land, you beach the thing, and you get them out, and they sleep on the beach, basically. And that sort of interested me, because it's a pattern. It's not a pattern we think of in naval matters. Yo?
What does a double-hulled ship look like? Is it a hull?
It's a hull, hull, and something connecting them. That's how a modern catamaran is. Gives you a very stable one, and the guess is that it was decked all the way over. And part of the explanation that's offered for why they tried to do that design was that in addition to hand-to-hand fighting, they were also using projectile weapons. They didn't have cannon, but they had, catapults and things of that sort. If you've got a crew on a deck, you'd like the deck to be as big as possible, because otherwise you're crowded in and you get killed every time anybody dumps a rock on you. And so the idea is that this design gave them a much larger deck, could have a bigger crew without having them in due
time.
If they're right, the whole deck is connecting them. If the interpretation I read is correct, and we don't really know for sure, you've got a hull here and a deck that goes all the way across. There might also be some other connecting things, I don't know. Modern catamarans aren't decked over normally, but they're 2 hulls. And they are apparently a fairly functional ship design, I'm told. Anyway, a long digression, but I thought it was sort of fun stuff when I read about it, so I thought I'd tell you about it. Yeah, it is a 40, that's right. Another interesting point, sort of minor point that struck me, is the business of auctioning loot at the mast. So if you think about this as a practical problem, we've captured a bunch of loot. There are 80 of us, and the loot consists mostly of a gold and silk clothes and some weapons, stuff we can divide up pretty easily and say everybody gets his share. But then there's this one necklace. Jeweled necklace. And suppose we believe it's worth more as a necklace than it is as separate jewels, which may or may not be true, but imagine it is. And that jeweled necklace is 10% of our loot, roughly. How do we divide it? All right. Well, one way is you break it up, but that might lower its value. How do they divide it? They auction it off. What they do is they say, all right, we're going to auction this at the mast. Any sailor can make a bid. High bid gets it. And then we take the money he's bid and divide it evenly among us. And that reminded me of something that happened to me a very, very long time ago. I was in London with a good friend. We were both interested in historical costume, as it happened. We were both associated with the same group that does historical recreation. And in a bookstore, we came across 2 copies of a fairly uncommon book that we both wanted, Norris's History of Costume, one of the volumes of it. And one of them was a newer volume in somewhat better shape than the other. And the question is, given that we both wanted them, how do we decide who got which? And we decided on a very simple solution. We bought both of them, and we then had an auction between ourselves. Who was willing to offer the other one more to get the better one? Except that after we had made this agreement and bought the books, And before we had done our auction, we discovered that the copy in less good condition was signed by the author. And my friend, unlike me, valued that. So it ended up that the auction went for the opposite sign of what we thought it was going to be. It ended up that the older book, he agreed to pay me some share of what we had paid for the books in exchange for his getting, which was fine with me, fine with him too. But in any case, it just reminded me of it because it is sort of a solution when you've got a lumpy thing and you want to convert it into money, find some way of seeing how much people value it at, which is what they were doing in that case. All right, I guess the last point I wanted to make, I didn't think that Chapter 8 was all that interesting, although it certainly got some neat stuff in it. But what is in a way interesting about it is that it's showing the connection between what economists call the theory of the firm and what other people think of as political science or political theory. That is to say that the same kinds of arguments for how you organize a pirate ship are both arguments about how you organize a country, if you think about the discussion of division of power and stuff of that sort, and arguments about how you set up a firm, that a firm and a company, and a country and a pirate ship are all a bunch of people who are trying to coordinate their activities. They all face very loosely the same sorts of problems in doing it, and therefore there's some sense in which a general theory of how human groups organize is relevant to all of those. And I thought that was what at least I found most interesting about that chapter. I guess it's not the final chapter, but it's the almost final chapter. Also, did anyone notice the dedication of the book? He mentions it in his introduction. His dedication is a proposal of marriage to his girlfriend who helped him with writing the book. What?
How did that work out for him?
I ought to know. At least I am reasonably sure that when I had dinner with him a year and a half ago, there was a woman present, so I assume he was married to her, though I don't really know. That was after the book was written. But the dedication is, Ania, I love you. Will you marry me? Well, that was classy. Anyway. All right. So look at the syllabus and see whether you're up for our next class, which two or three of you, I think, are. I think we've lost a person who's one of them. And those both look like interesting papers, though I don't know if they're the most interesting because I haven't read all the rest because I haven't gotten them yet. But I, at least about four or five, probably maybe five people got the papers in early, so I had some selection. Yeah. Oh, I see. So check the syllabus, and if you're not up, you are supposed to read the papers that are linked to the syllabus so that you can tell their authors what's wrong with them, what they ought to improve, give them ideas, and so forth.